of the management and the staff of Hayden Commercial College here tonight, I want to extend a very warm welcome to you to this the fifth and the final event in which we've been celebrating the college's 20th anniversary. Some of you will know that three of the earlier events were held in churches in various parts of the Highlands and Islands, and in that way reflecting something of our major stakeholders. The fourth event was an academic lecture back in Moray College, and that was very much an acknowledgement of, I think, what we might call our incubation, or a period of incubation, as they incubated us for the first 5 years of their existence as we then were Highland Theological Institute. And that academic lecture also celebrated the life of a son of Ellen, whom many of you will know, the late F. F. Bruce, regarded as one of the most distinguished British New Testament scholars of the 20th century. So we're hoping that in years to come, HBC will produce those kinds of scholars as well. In various fields of theological studies. Tonight's event is a little different. It celebrates Reformed theology's interest and therefore Highland Theological College's interest in the wider world of education, of culture, of the arts, and so on. From the beginning of involvement with the university or the university project as it was then, HTC has provided opportunities, particularly for folks in its local area, around Aymore, so in Gloucestershire, provided opportunities for folks from that area to access degree studies in programs other than theology. So we've had students studying Gaelic, sustainable development, archaeology, literature, cultural studies, and Scottish history, as well as some other programs as well. We've also taught some of our theology modules have been delivered into some of the other degrees, like cultural studies and Scottish history. And more recently, one of our staff members, Dr. Dennis Desapi, has been the university's program leader for responsible for developing a new philosophy, politics and economics degree in UHI. So that kind of activity by members of academic staff of HTC may come as a surprise to some of you. Innocent's intention in all of that is someday in the future to have a full philosophy degree in place as well. So in line with that wider interest of Reformed theology and wider interest of HTC as well, it's my very great privilege to welcome as our guest speaker this evening, journalist and author, Dr. Harry Reid, perhaps known best in some of you as Corporate Editorship of the Herald from 1997 to 2000. What many of you may not know is that for over a decade now, Harry has been an enthusiastic supporter, and we will go beyond that and say an enthusiastic advocate of HTC. And that really has come about because he's actually not looked at us from a distance, but actually come and seen us and spoken to us and engaged with us. And as a result of that, and of his own studies, using the library, the college library, by researching for a number of his books, including Outside Verdict and Reformation, The Dangerous Birth of the Modern World, and his next book, whose title he will mention in a few moments, soon to be published. As a token of his gratitude to the college, back in 2009, Harry commissioned a sculpture bust of John Calvin. Those of you who have visited the college will have seen that mounted on the wall of the boardroom in the college. So John Calvin there overseeing a should say, of course, in a very non-Episcopalian way, overseeing all the proceedings of all the august and otherwise bodies who gather in that place. So tonight, Harry's going to speak about the way in which Christian faith has influenced the life and writing of some of the man's John Ruffin, but also some other eminent 20th century Scottish writers. And after that, you'll have an opportunity of flying in with questions. And so, also, that's enough for me. A very warm welcome to Dr. Harry Mead.
Ladies and gentlemen, John Buchan has always been a hero of mine. He was a man who excelled in many areas, but my view is that he achieved most as a writer and indeed as a Christian writer. I would like to suggest tonight that his magnificent novel Witchwood is not just the finest Scottish religious novel of the 20th century, but it might quite possibly be the finest Scottish novel of the century. Now, Buchan's father was a committed Calvinist, and Buchan very much imbued his values, but Witchwood excels as a critique, not of Calvinism, but of the distortions of Calvinism which have occasionally blighted our country over the years. Buchan himself was an intensely devout Christian, of that there can be no doubt. Born the son of a Free Church minister, he learned to say his prayers every day, a habit he never once dropped during his years of intensive public service. He could quote long passages from Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress as well as the Bible by heart. And in the evening of his life, he produced a very powerful clarion call for the revival of Christianity. Let me quote, "The quality of our religion is being put to the test. I am of Blake's view. Man must and will have some religion. If he has not the religion of Jesus, he will have the religion of Satan. I believe that civilization must have a Christian basis and must ultimately rest on the Christian church. Today, our faith is being attacked, and the attack is succeeding. 30 years ago, Europe was nominally a Christian continent. It is no longer so." Now, these words were written in 1939, and he was obviously thinking, at least in part, of Nazism. But he was also penning what he always believed was a wider and more profound truth, which is that the true richness in our world is the gospel of Christ. Buchan strongly believed, if we lose Christ, we lose all. Now, in today's much more secular times, many Scots might regard the passage just quoted, unfortunately, they might regard it as the ranting of a fanatic or the haverings of a zealot. Buchan was emphatically not either of these. He was a multifaceted, able man of the world, one who excelled in many fields. When he died, the editor of the Times said that the newspaper had never received so many tributes, unsolicited tributes, to a public figure, pouring in from people of all walks of life all over the world. There was absolutely nothing narrow or oppressive in Buchan's disposition. He moved in many circles and he crammed an amazing amount of life-enhancing effort into his 64 years. He achieved much success in the secular world. But then, to say that he was successful does, of course, beg various questions. He did have many critics, and one of the more perceptive was the Catholic novelist Graham Greene, who accused him of worshipping success and materialism. For me, his most eloquent, if not necessarily his most perceptive critic, was the radical Scottish educationist R.F. Mackenzie, Robert Mackenzie, who was the closest to a genuine prophet I've ever met, and a man who actually despised Buchan. Can't mince my words, he despised Buchan. Mackenzie believed that Buchan condescended to ordinary folk. He consistently chased the mighty or the influential, and he hankered after the life of a landed gent. Indeed, he reckoned that from his schoolboy years, Buchan was determined on one thing, advancement. But advancement in England, not in Scotland. On the other hand, the man who was probably the greatest Scottish writer of the 20th century, the poet Hugh MacDiarmid, he was much more ambivalent. He could be very caustic about Buchan, but he was generous enough to appreciate that Buchan wrote very, very well. Like many others, he thought that Buchan wasted his true potential as a Scottish writer because he resided in Oxfordshire, where he lived the life of a rural squire. And McDermott certainly cared enough about Buchan and his talent to want him to return to Scotland. In fact, at times he pleaded with him to return to Scotland. Buchan himself once let slip, I think a very revealing remark, that he thought Scotland produced more very good second-class people than any other country in the world, but very few of the first class. I'm not sure if he thought he was in the first class, but I suspect he probably didn't, to be fair to him. His own career, while superficially one of enormous public success, never satisfied him. He did inherit much from his father, who, although easygoing in persona, was deep down a hardline-driven Calvinist. Buchan's personal Calvinism manifested itself in many ways, but I think most in all in a pressing sense of duty and a constant awareness of evil lurking everywhere, often where it was not expected. Now, Buchan was born almost 150 years ago in Perth in 1875, on the day of his mother's 18th birthday. The next year, the family moved to Kirkcaldy, where he had a splendid childhood. Always a great walker, he once strode across country for a remarkable 63 miles without any significant break at all. As a wee boy, he walked every day over 3 miles to his school and 3 miles back. He belonged to the local gang, who could be quite wild in an innocent sort of way. They once set some barrels on fire and rolled them into a derelict quarry. He lived as a boy for his summer holidays, which were spent in the borders at his grandparents' farm at Broughton, where his grandfather was an elder in the Free Kirk. He was very proud that he came from border stock, and during these long, fondly remembered summers, he befriended shepherds and he tramped the hills. He became acquainted with poachers working the River Tweed. I believe that no one has ever written better, no one, about the Scottish landscape than John Buchan. The Scottish borders gave him, as he later recalled, happiness, security, adventure and nostalgia. But he also wrote very well indeed about the Highlands and the Islands, not least in his ambitious novel, Mr. Standfast, which has a notable passage set in the Coolin of Skye, and in a much lighter book, John McNab. His father became minister of the John Knox Church in the Gorbals, just south of the Clyde in the heart of industrial Glasgow. Unlike his son, the father was never driven or ambitious. In his spare time, he would quietly arrange flowers. Although he was something of a dreamer, he was a committed minister, and he sometimes preached in impromptu style outside his church. John went to school and university in Glasgow and then on to Brasenose College, Oxford, which of course was also the college of our beloved Prime Minister. Later, he wrote that he was, quote, an intolerable prig at Oxford. He was older than most of his college contemporaries, and he disapproved of most of them. He thought he had been, in his phrase, pitchforked into a kindergarten. The revels of the, again I'm quoting, alcoholic children among his fellow undergraduates greatly offended him. A plain speaker, he soon became unpopular with the emancipated schoolboys that he found himself among. Whatever, if he was a bit of a prig, he was an industrious one, very industrious. He was president of the Oxford Union, he won the Newdigate Prize for Poetry, and he wrote a history of his college. By the time he left Oxford, he was already listed in Who's Who. This frenetic activity continued as he made his way in the wider world. He had written his first novel in 1895 when he was 20, and another 7 books were produced before he left Oxford. In London, he produced much fluent journalism, and he read manuscripts for a publisher. He also read for the Bar, and then left the UK to become a colonial administrator in South Africa. And then he returned to London to work as a specialist in tax law. He married Susan Grosvenor, who counted the Duke of Wellington among her forebears. She would sometimes joke, tell a story about the Duke when he was one day striding down Piccadilly, and a man came up to him and said, "Mr. Jones, I believe," at which the Duke stared at him and said, "If you believe that, you'll believe anything." Although he patronised his wife, calling her my dear child, the marriage was very successful and happy. At this time in his life, Buchan was something of a dabbler, if a high-end one. He worked as a novelist, a journalist, a lawyer, and as a publisher. During the First World War, he was a war correspondent, and in 1917 he became the government's director of information. Shortly after the war, he bought Elsfield Manor, about 5 miles northeast of Oxford, on the fringe of Otmoor, and he had grown to love the surprisingly wild country round about Otmoor during his student days, and Elsfield was without doubt the place where he was to be happiest. I myself got to know Otmoor quite well during the late 60s when I was at Oxford, and even then it was, though close to the city, a very strange and bereft area with an isolated and grim feel. It was prone to sudden mists and even fogs. Most of the so-called seven towns of Otmoor were in fact tiny and rather unprepossessing and grim hamlets in which time stood still. Anyway, Buchan had found in Elsfield a place to love and cherish, significantly, I think, not in Scotland. He set his Saturdays aside for rambles across Otmoor or further afield to places like Brill on the Hill, although the hill was tiny by Scottish standards. He claimed that Otmoor was, quote, as remote from man as Neudart or Barra. And he loved wandering through this mysterious waste with its pitted mud tracks. But I do reckon that Buchan protested too much when he compared Otmoor to wild and lonely parts of the Scottish Highlands and Islands. He had settled into the life of an Oxfordshire squire, and to some extent, as he must have realised, he had turned his back on Scotland. In his most popular story, The 39 Steps, there is a passage which I've always thought is psychologically revealing. After the brilliantly described adventures in the Galloway Hills, the plot requires the book's hero, Richard Hannay, to rendezvous with a Foreign Office mandarin by the banks of the River Kennet in Berkshire. And we are told, after Scotland, the air smelt heavy and flat, but infinitely sweet. Although he could write beautifully, with both precision and awe, about the Scottish landscape, I reckon that it was the Oxfordshire and Berkshire landscapes that he came to love the most. His eloquent critic, who I've already mentioned, R.F. Mackenzie, insisted that he always wanted to live not like a Scottish laird, which for Mackenzie would have been bad enough, but like an English lord of the manor. On Sundays he would worship at the local Anglican church. Now, he did assure his mother that he would never ever be an Episcopalian. Indeed, he claimed that Scottish Presbyterianism was in his bones. But he was ambivalent in the latter part of his life about whether or not he'd become an Episcopalian. I think this ambivalence was a bit reminiscent of Sir Walter Scott. Certainly, sometimes he let his guard slip a little, and he did disclose a strong dislike of Scottish clerics. And in a brief but significant passage in the 39 Steps, he gives a hilarious account of a political meeting in the Borders. Now, it is, as I'm sure you all know, a very fast-moving narrative, and there was no need at all to even mention the chairman of the meeting, but Buchan succumbed to temptation, describing him as a weaselly minister with a reddish nose, who soliloquised on his influenza. If Buchan's approach to Christianity was broad-minded, his personal religion was deep, intense, and sincere, although in religion, as in much else, he did sometimes have a tendency to succumb to snobbery. In literature, where I think he did excel, he was strongly influenced by R.L. Stevenson, but in later life, significantly, he came to dislike Stevenson's novels. One of his friends, the Oxford historian E.L. Rouse, said Buchan came to feel that Stevenson had altogether too much artifice as a writer, and Buchan felt that Stevenson's optimism and masculinity were essentially opposed. He was elected MP for the Scottish universities, which he represented in the Tory interest in the House of Commons, where there were some unpleasant remarks, indeed some quite nasty sneering, about his voice. Remarks were made about his Freekirk whine, his man's intonation, his mincing tones. Despite his Toryism, he greatly liked and admired Ramsay MacDonald, his fellow Scot, who as Labour leader was reviled as a traitor by his own party for forming a national government. Buchan, too, was treated with suspicion by some on his side. He was never, ever offered the cabinet post that he really thought he deserved. Indeed, some regarded him as something of a dilettante. He told the Tory leader and Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin that politics had always been his chief interest, which was certainly not true. In his frustration, there was maybe just a whiff of what that other prominent and sometimes peevish Scot, John Rees, was also to suffer. Buchan had been bitterly disappointed when he was not elected to a fellowship at Oxford's most prestigious college, All Souls, back in 1899, and that rankled for many years, as did his failure to gain a significant honour for his work during the First World War. He actually enlisted the support of many of the great and the good to lobby on his behalf, but to no avail. Later he became embroiled in a quite unedifying dispute with Nelson's, the firm which published most of his books and where he still worked part-time. The squabble was about money, pure and simple. Buchan felt he was very underpaid. Before his wedding, he collapsed from excessive nervous tension. I just mention these things, I hope not unkindly, but just to point out that his life was by no means as smooth as has sometimes been suggested. He was absolutely delighted when in 1933 and again in 1934, he was asked to serve as Lord High Commissioner to the Kirk's General Assembly. He was actually not first choice, but he took to the post with aplomb. He had a profound sense of Scottish religious history, he adored ceremony, and he also knew that his mother, in particular, would be delighted. Then he was appointed Governor General of Canada, which was his last significant public post, and ennobled at long last as Lord Tweedsmuir of Elsfield, and I think that is significant. Tweedsmuir in Scotland, Elsfield in England. And his time in Canada was a great success, although he certainly did not warm to the Canadian Premier, Mackenzie King. He had a much warmer relationship with the outstanding US politician of the time, Franklin Roosevelt. King was a Calvinist of the old school and was actually very shocked when Buchan told him that he did not personally believe in predestination. John Buchan died early in 1940. Superficially, it had been a glittering career, but was it? He had crammed too many tasks, too many offices into his relatively brief life. He took all his posts very seriously, and yet the world did not always respond to him as he expected it to. As a young man, he was often talked of as a future Prime Minister, and he never came close to that. And while his novels were enormously successful, he is now remembered mainly for what he called his shockers, particularly the Richard Hannay stories, rather than his more serious fiction. He also wrote various biographies, full of insights, but sometimes too hastily written, of great men like Montrose, Walter Scott, Oliver Cromwell. But I believe that where he really excelled was as a writer of serious fiction, and in some ways I wish he concentrated more, certainly in the latter years of his life, on writing fiction. I also believe that he wrote two genuinely great novels, which I am about to discuss. And I just want to conclude this sort of introductory biography by saying he was never a fashionable man, and he never really became a real insider, a pillar of the establishment, although he did in a way try. There was always something elusive, I think, about John Buchan. It was said of him he was a Scotsman when in England, and an honorary Englishman when in Scotland. In physique, he was very lean and wiry. This had helped him in his youth when he would roam over the border hills for mile after mile. But as he became more and more prone to illness in the second half of his life, he found that he lacked physical strength. And his mind remained very strong, but his body became more and more weak. And his poor health was matched by a certain unease with himself and with the wider world. His Christian faith, while, as I've emphasized, was strong and sincere, was certainly not of the kind to provide any easy comfort. In part, these various tensions made him the very fine writer that he was. His many years of public service certainly allowed him to understand just how the world works, but he was not kidded. His deep, if private, Calvinism kept him aware that darkness was always there or thereabouts. He understood that civilization was fragile, that man's capacity for barbarism was never conquered, and he did have a real living sense of the evil that stalked and still stalks our world. Now, as I've suggested, I think he wrote too many books, fiction and non-fiction. He wrote some of them in great rushed interludes between his many public duties. But I do think the best two are the ones I've mentioned, quite outstanding novels, one set in 17th century Scotland, Witchwood, and the other, his last novel, written when he was dying, set in 20th century Canada, Sick Heart River. Now, Witchwood was his own favourite among his novels. He thought it was historically true, and he incorporated in the story much of the research for his biography of Montrose, who actually appears in the novel, though not as a major figure. He had actually written in his youth a very slapdash biography of Montrose, and he decided to rewrite it in 1926 and 1927. And he mined this work to provide the quite superbly realised background of his fictive masterpiece. Witchwood is a novel of many merits. Among these are its sense of place. Buchan was writing about the country round about Broughton, which he knew and loved as a boy and youth, but he was imagining it as it had been 250 years earlier, when it was far, far more wooded. He did write many of his novels as entertainments, but Witchwood is a work of deadly and deep seriousness. It amounts, I have to say, to a full frontal assault on the excesses of Calvinism and of the Covenanters. But Buchan was actually ambivalent about the Covenanters. He's only condemning some of the Covenanters. In his biography of Montrose, he actually wrote that if the Covenanters gave manhood and liberty to Scotland, they also did much to sap the first and to shackle the second, which is almost like equivocation, I think. My good friend, the journalist and writer Arnold Kemp, was always convinced that this very powerful book, Witchwood, is really a morality tale with a very simple theme. If you repress men and women with an unduly grim religion, then you will drive them to excessive and perhaps perverted delights. Well, I don't really quite go along with that. I think the theme is much broader. I think Buchan just wanted to bring out what he thought was the perversion of Calvinism, because he was a Calvinist himself, as I've tried to emphasise, that the perversion of Calvinism which besmirched Scotland in the middle of the 17th century. The barbaric activities which the young, ingenuous minister, who is the hero of the book, David Semple, slowly realises are taking place in his parish were no doubt, to some extent, a revolt against religious repression. But it was a revolt that was inexcusable in its excess. Now, in the novel, overzealous Calvinism is represented by two of Semple's fellow ministers. As I say, Buchan was also quite unpleasant about ministers. These were two really odious gentlemen whose oily religiosity is presented with both subtlety and force as nothing less than an abomination. These are strong words, but it is, as I say, a very, very strong novel. When he arrives in his parish, David Semple is an innocent. He is at first enchanted with the great wood. Slowly and bitterly he understands that it has become a hateful place of fear and evil, a vast, gloom-laden setting for devilry. In the heart of it there is a pagan altar, where women and men wearing grotesque masks celebrate a perverted version of the Christian sacrament. Now Semple bravely confronts this devilment, but with considerable cynicism, his own presbytery eventually excommunicates him for his pains. One of his few supporters, a decent but drunken farmer, suggests to the minister that the excesses of the new Presbyterianism merely drove the parishioners back to their bad old ways, and indeed, worse, made them hypocrites as well as sinners. Similar views are held by the one local minister who supports Semple, significantly a man who is weak both in courage and physique. But David Semple himself becomes crazed in his zeal to exterminate the evil around him. One of his enemies, an unco-good elder, is directly driven by Semple to madness. All this, as you're probably gathering, is very strong meat indeed. I think Witchwood is a dark and profound novel about Scotland. What makes it yet more compelling is the scrupulous care with which Buchan fills in the historical background. I think the novel also anticipates Grassic Gibbon's Sunset Song, which was written just a year or so later. in Buchan's understanding of the rhythms of the farming year, lambing, sowing, harvest, and then the blackness of winter. There are certainly some magnificent set pieces in this relatively brief novel. They include a witch hunt and Semple's trial before his presbytery when the hypocrisy overflows. And there are some romantic interludes which Buchan just about carries off, although he was never very good writing about women. The heroine, Katrine Yester, is in fact presented not realistically, but rather as a symbol of goodness amid all the darkness and the doom. Buchan subtly decided to suggest rather than graphically describe evil and depravity, but some of the scenes are nonetheless direct and vivid and even brutal. His description of a hunted, tortured so-called witch, delirious and squirming on the ground, is harrowing. Scene after scene builds to the grand critique of what Buchan called the demented twist of Calvin's doctrines, which could blast and rob a man's heart. Another set piece, powerful set piece, occurs when Semple comes across a group of drunken Covenanters who, like a pack of terriers, have chased and cornered a cat, except that the cat in this case is a poor Irish woman, a wretched creature who is lying prostrate with her clothes torn and her feet raw and bloody and her neck wounded. She dies before Semple's eyes. As he researched his revised biography of Montrose, Buchan had become psychologically immersed in mid-17th century Scotland, one of the most turbulent periods in our history, and also a time, it has to be said, of genuine and heroic greatness. And here we have the very paradox of the Covenanters. As I've suggested, I simply, personally, cannot make up my mind about them. There is so much to admire, but there is also a lot to condemn. And as I say, Buchan himself also equivocated about them. His novel sums up the best of the Covenanting position thus: you are faithful to your king so long as the king is faithful to law and to the true religion. And your loyalty to the kirk is the same. You are faithful to your kirk so long as the kirk is faithful to law and to the true religion. So while Buchan was ambivalent about the Covenanters and the alert to the enormous complexities of Calvinism, which he was quite happy to attack, his great novel is by no means a one-dimensional attack on the doctrines of John Calvin. Far from it. But at the same time, as I'm suggesting, the excesses of the Covenanters, their fanatical belief in a fairly extreme version of Christianity, are presented with great gusto. So I think this book is a literary masterpiece. In the long, long progress of Scottish fiction, it is the ultimate antidote to Kailyard sentimentality, more forceful even than great earlier works, like that very fine but sadly totally forgotten novel Gillespie, written by a Church of Scotland minister, MacDougall Hay, or indeed the better-known House with the Green Shutters. Witchwood has a significance, I think, beyond literary history, because the novel explores Scottish Christianity and its underbelly, with insight and sometimes even horror. And you are forced to question as you read it what kind of people we Scots are and have been. It is almost inevitably a disturbing book because it is written by a staunch Christian who understands the devil. It is also a suffocating story, not just because of the vileness of some of the characters, but because of the very weakness, the weakness of the good folk who support the young minister Semple. And indeed, as I reread it quite recently, a subversive thought occurred to me. Is Semple's parish really a metaphor for Scotland as a whole? Is Buchan indicting not just the more extreme Covenanters and a group of hypocritical Calvinists, but rather Scotland itself? Is he writing an angry lament for Scotland's problematic relationship with Christianity? Well, I actually don't think so, but he could be. Anyway, after all this darkness, it is a real relief for me, and hopefully for you too, to turn to Sickheart River, which, it must be said, is a gentler and more redemptive novel. It was written when John Buchan was himself dying, and it is, in one sense anyway, the very moving story of a dying man. This man, Edward Leithen, is on a peculiar mission in the remote wilderness of far northwest Canada. Buchan was always good at taking the context of what he was doing at the time and using it for his fiction, and of course by this time he was Governor General of Canada. The book's hero, Edward Leithen, is searching for another man who has vanished in the wilderness, and in so doing he is really searching for his own soul, with death imminent. And it is a much kinder book than Witchwood, but there is one great similarity. Sick Heart River is imbued with an intense sense of place, and Buchan does not hold back in his description of the harshness of the huge bleak immensities, as he calls them. He describes a vast hostile landscape, quote, where man is nothing and God is all. Now, Leeson himself had once been a hardline Calvinist. He has mellowed, although in this great wilderness he is ever more aware of the strength of God, and he ruminates on his religion and he rejects what he calls the glib little humanism of his times. As for the plot, well, he is seeking to find, to rescue and save a tormented man, a distinguished New York banker. This man's abrupt rejection of his apparently successful worldly life and his flight to the wilds is never really explained. And indeed, the nature of Leeson's own journey is also mysterious. There is in the whole novel the sense of an extended and rather vague but very moving parable. There is nothing wispy about it. The writing is clear and diamond hard. At the very spiritual conclusion, Leeson is in an encampment of Hare Indians, who are partly of Scottish descent, and whose bereft and isolated community has been completely racked by illness and privation. And in fact, they have given up. They've succumbed. They are mired in despair and disease. But Leeson himself has recovered a little in the wilderness, having finally found the banker. And he now summons the strength to encourage the Indians to find strength too. So although he's dying, he makes a great spiritual recovery. And somehow, almost Christ-like, the spent Leeson rallies them, and in so doing exhausts himself and dies, having at last found genuine peace. So this man who has deliberately gone into the vast lonely wasteland to save another man now saves an entire community. Leeson gives the Indians the will to live just as he's preparing for his own imminent death. As Buchan writes, in sympathy with others, he lost all care for himself. Well, obviously enough, Sick Heart River is not a particularly Scottish book in the sense that Witchwood is. But Leeson's long and harrowing journey across the brilliantly described wilderness is obviously not just a physical one. It is also, in the best sense, a Christian quest. This is Buchan's most profoundly religious work, for it's seriously and deeply redemptive in a way that I don't think Witchwood is. If I can quote R.F. McKenzie, Buchan's great critic once again, his slightly sour slant on all this, which I reject, was that Buchan was just trying to expiate his own faults by sending one of his more sympathetic characters into a very bleak territory in order to find salvation. The conclusion to this most rewarding and most Christian of novels is full of hope, although it is earlier in the narrative that Leeson senses that a great mercifulness is beginning to break on him like a sunrise. And this does anticipate the religious nature of his final recovery and renewal. He also realises that he had always hoped to die in April, when the surge of returning life would be a kind of earnest of immortality. And at that moment, he recovers the tenderness he has lost. Tenderness is the word Buchan uses, and it might be a peculiar word to use of a successful worldly man now desperately struggling in a hostile environment. But then it was no doubt his worldly success that had made him lose his human tenderness. Buchan himself, as he was writing these words, is about to die. He is finally turning away from the quest for worldly success and reaching out to the ultimate Christian verity. Now, I see I've actually been talking for almost 45 minutes, and it's totally up to you. I'll stop now and we can have questions. I was maybe going to say one or two things about some other Scottish writers, but I've been talked maybe a bit too much about Buchan. Whichever you want. Shall we have some questions? Or do you want me to carry on a wee bit? Well, thank you. As you've probably gathered, I'm a great fan of Buchan. Looking at Scottish writers the last century, the first thing I have to say generally is that many of the best ones were very, very hostile to Christianity. If you take Grassic Gibbon, Sunset Song, now generally regarded as the greatest Scottish novel of the 20th century. I reread it recently and was amazed. I'd forgotten how nasty and even spiteful the character of Gibbon, the minister, is. I mean, he's just presented as a buffoon, but a pretty unpleasant, hypocritical buffoon. But throughout Gibbon, there was a lot of unpleasantness. I think McDermott, if Classic Gibbon is supposed to have been our greatest novelist of the last century, I think McDermott is generally recognised as without doubt the greatest poet, very difficult poet. Now, McDermott is interesting. He was brought up in Langham, in a Free Church household. The local Free Church minister, a man called Cairncross, who himself was quite a good poet, befriended him and was very helpful to him. McDermott, in his early teens, was a most enthusiastic Sunday school teacher. And it was only really, I think, when he started moving towards communism that he rejected his Christianity. But he never really rejected it. I think McDermott wrote far too much. I mean, I think the great poems are absolutely magnificent, but he wrote a lot of journalism, dare I say it. He wrote a lot of essays and literary criticism, all sorts of things, and he contradicted himself. But if you trawl through quite a lot of what he keeps coming back to Christianity. And he sometimes talks about the great truth of the resurrection, which is obviously not somebody who is an atheist, something an atheist would do. So I think McDermott's rejection of Christianity was, to put it gently, only partial. Looking at some of the other writers, there's a man, probably some of you here know more about than I do, I've got a man called Fionn McCullough. I don't know if any of you know anything about him. He was a headmaster. He was born in Montrose, I think, and brought up as a Plymouth Brethren. And this scarred him. He rejected that sort of extreme kind of Christianity very quickly and converted to Catholicism. And he became a teacher up in something in West Ross, I'm sorry, I can't remember. Eventually became a headmaster. And he wrote two or three novels. The most famous is called Undercock Crew, which are they're very peculiar. I think they're hard going, but they are, in a sense, deeply Catholic novels, although I'm not really equipped to talk about what a Catholic novel is. But also, when we're talking about Scottish literature and Christianity, I think it's maybe important to mention George Mackay Brown. My good friend Ron Ferguson, who, as many of you here will know, was the minister of St. Magnus Cathedral for quite a few years. And when he retired, he wrote a very interesting book about Mackay Brown. And the centrepiece in the book is Mackay Brown's conversion to Catholicism. And I think Ron decides pretty clearly that what happened was Mackay Brown very much was a Christian. He believed in Christianity, but he wanted, to use the old-fashioned, slightly glib phrase, smells and bells. He wanted a more sensual religion, a warmer religion. And that, according to Ron, I think in essence is why he became a Catholic. Another Scottish writer who became a Catholic for similar reasons was Muriel Spark, who was brought up in Edinburgh in the Jewish faith, and then she suddenly converted to Catholicism in her 30s, and she amazingly said, I wanted to be a novelist, but I didn't think I could write a novel unless I became a Catholic. I'm not quite sure what the thinking process was, but again, you have another writer who became a Catholic, yet another Scottish writer, Compton Mackenzie, who was very, very popular 20, 30, 40 years ago. I don't think he's read so much now. But he, again, I don't think he actually converted to Catholicism. I think he'd always been a sort of vague Catholic, but he became a much more enthusiastic Catholic later in his life. And it's very hard to look the other way around and say, well, were there any Catholics who converted to Protestantism? I certainly don't know of any. But the other thing I would say is there is here this, without doubt, among these writers, this kind of rejection of what they see as a sort of grimness in Scottish Protestantism, which rightly or wrongly they felt they were shoving aside when they became Catholics. Funnily enough, I mentioned Graham Greene and what he said about Buchan. Graham Greene was a very great Catholic writer, but there was absolutely nothing warm or I would say easy or pleasant about his novels, his religious novels. Most of them are religious one way or the other. I think are some of the grimmest novels I've ever read. I mean, they're very, very bleak. So I'm not saying something quite as crass as if you want to read a kind of warm version of Christianity, read a Catholic novelist. It's not quite as simple as that. But it is interesting that there are at least two other Scottish writers, I'm trying to remember who they were, in the 20th century who did convert from being Protestants to Catholicism. So I think that's quite an interesting thing. But anyway, can we maybe have some questions? Yes.
You said that the Buchan wasn't a hardline Calvinist. I was wondering if he was a Calvinist at all, if he rejected the doctrine of predestination.
Well, he certainly believed that you could, and he did. This was a correspondence and, in fact, a conversation he had with Mackenzie King, who I mentioned, who was an Orthodox Calvinist and believed in predestination. But Buchan says several times in the course of his writings that you can be a Calvinist and not believe in predestination. Now, in this audience, of all audiences, I'm not going to say if that's possible or not. All sorts of people here could give, I'm sure, a much more definitive view on that. But certainly Buchan sincerely did. Now, Andrew, who's sitting in the front row here, I was reminding me earlier, once told me that I'd never make a theologian. I don't think that John Buchan would ever have been a theologian either. And maybe to some extent, as one of my themes has been, that he almost didn't exactly make it up as he went along, but he did write too much and he did do too many things. He was always a very, very busy man. Possibly it was nonsensical of him to claim, but he certainly did claim that you could be a Calvinist and reject predestination. Yes.
Another Scots writer who wrote well about landscape in a different way, of course, was Hugh Miller.
Yes.
And I wondered if Buchan, there was any evidence of Buchan had ever read over in sandstone or in some of Hugh Miller's landscape writing.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. I know not too far from Cromarty, and I should know more about Hugh Miller. Forgive me, I don't know very much about him. But Buchan must, I think, have read. He certainly must have known about Hugh Miller, and he must have read a bit, because he did read very, very widely. But as to whether... No, I'm sorry, I can't really say any more now. Yes. Yeah.
The both characters that have an epiphany,
yeah.
Have a journey. Yeah. And how much do you think that mirrors Buchan's own life? Because you mentioned at the beginning of your talk that he felt all the way for the nation of Ireland was convinced Christianity. Do you think he had a journey himself? Was a mirror from Semple and Leithen?
Well, I'm not so sure about Semple. Certainly Leithen, yes. I think... I reread both these novels I was talking about quite recently, and I became increasingly certain in Sick Heart River that Leithen is really, he's writing about himself, in essence. So I would certainly say yes there. And of course, Leithen is dying just as Buchan knows he's dying. Not quite so sure about Semple. I think Semple's almost actually, and I'm not a sophisticated literary critic, it's maybe become quite obvious tonight, but I think Semple's almost a kind of device for him to just, you know, I don't really think he saw much of himself. I think that the idea of having this innocent young minister coming into this place where there's devil worship going on and so many of the other Christians are hypocritical, even if they're not directly involved in the devil worship, he needed to, you know, a narrative device to bring it out, and so sending in a young and innocent minister was the way. But you might well be right. I mean, maybe there is something of Buchan. The only thing I think that would maybe make me suspicious, Semple is very much an innocent, and he's naive. And this maybe sounds unkind, but I don't think Buchan ever regarded himself as an innocent or naive. He was very much, as I tried to bring out, a man of the world, and he felt he knew his way around the world and he could make his way in the world. And I think that's actually one of the beautiful things, again, about Sickheart River, because this is a man who, I don't think he ever said, I'm going to be Prime Minister or I want to be Prime Minister, but he was certainly talked about as a young man, as a future Prime Minister. And I do think the fact that his public career, the highest office he had was Governor General of Canada. Now, that's a great office. I'm not demeaning it, but I suspect he probably thought that, you know, he could have something more in his public life. But, I mean, basic theme of all this, I just wish he'd written more and been less interested in being Governor General or an MP or whatever, because I think if he'd been more or less a full-time writer, I don't think there'd have been anybody to beat him. And I've got to say, I would include Scott and Stevenson. I think he was talented enough as a writer to be better than either of them. I really believe that. But he wasn't, I mean, given what we've got. I mean, I couldn't claim that the actual corpus we have.
Can you recommend anything on Buchan which reflects his spiritual life? I mean, most biographies don't in any great detail.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think the two main biographies are Janet Adam Smith's, the first one, which really says very little about his spiritual life. And I think, if I remember rightly, the more recent one by Andrew Lowney goes into it a little more. Now, I think there is a book by a literary scholar, not a religious man particularly, I don't think, called David Daniel. Have you heard of it? Yes. And have you read it? No. I did read it a long time ago, but I think that there was in it, I mean, it's basically a piece of literary criticism, except I think there is in it a bit more about his spiritual life. But it's the kind of thing, I've got to say, that is crying out for a thesis. Some nice young literary Christian in Scotland could write a super thesis on it, right? Yes?
There's also a book called John Buchan, a Memoir by his son William.
Oh, right.
Which I think was published about 20 years ago. And it was very much about his father, of course.
Right.
Very revealing, but his family life.
Yes. I'm afraid I haven't come across that. Yeah. Okay. But I mean, I did come across a book which I've actually used quite a bit, John Buchan by his friends, which was published shortly after he died. His wife has a chapter in it which is full of affection and, you know, her love for him. But there are some quite revealing things in it. But William Buchan, his son, no, I didn't know about that. Anybody else?
John Buchan never been in Inverness because he mentions Dr. Harry in, I think it's John McNair.
Yeah, and I certainly think, is there not an Inverness scene in Mr. Standfast? There's a long sequence in the middle of Mr. Standfast. It starts up in the Coolin, and then I certainly think they go to Dingwall, and I think they maybe pass through here when he's... I mean, as ever with Buchan, you know, he loves chases, and people are always being chased, and there's an extended chase now. But apart from that, Inverness, no, it's a very good point, actually. Can't think of anything else. It's a long time since I read John McNab, but Inverness doesn't feature up under a disguised Inverness doesn't feature it. No. Do you know where Crask was supposed to be? That was Archie Roylance's shooting house. Do you know where that was supposed to be? I think somebody... It's like very similar, the 39 steps, which I knew I'd end up talking about. The actual journey, you know, when Hannay gets off the train at somewhere near Newton Stewart and then eventually ends up at Moffat. And all the adventures were evidently meticulously planned. I mean, he did work out a route. But various people have tried to work out exactly where each adventure took place, you know, the literary innkeeper and so on. But I don't think anybody's ever quite worked out a definitive. Although Nelson's, the publishers, were supposed to have a map that he'd drawn, but that disappeared.
Do you think Harry consciously built James Cook.
Well, they're certainly, obviously, Richwood similar. I might as well be honest. I've read Private Memoirs and Confessions three times, and I've never yet found it quite the actual masterpiece that so many people say it is. I mean, it's obviously got a profound grasp on psychology, and the narrative, the way he tells it, you know, through different narrators, is very impressive and technically. So, to be honest, I think maybe not. I mean, I'm sure he, I mean, I think he was wanting to explore this. He himself said he really wrote Witchwood as a result of his researches when he was researching his biography of Montrose. And I think, I haven't actual evidence for this, I think he'd gone into the Montrose project still thinking the Covenanters were great guys. And I know, by the way, that not everybody in this room thinks they were great guys, because there's a certain librarian here tonight, can't see who he is, who I know thinks they were anything but great guys. But, I mean, I think, as I tried to explain, I'm ambivalent about him, and I think he was. Anyway, to answer your question, I really don't know.
More questions? Harry, many thanks for that very informative.
To make a few thanks too, but yep. You go, okay. You carry on. Yeah.
Okay, if you've been reading my Facebook blog or whatever you call it this morning, you've seen my comments I would rather have had my wife up here, since when it comes to Scottish literature and a bit of a cultural philistine, I have to confess. So most of that was totally new for me this evening, so it gives me an opportunity for going to explore some of these avenues. So many thanks to Harry for what he shared with us, for even dealing with your questions. We'll say a word of thanks to him. I express our thanks in a moment. But thank you all to yourselves for giving up to complete this evening and other things for spending time with us. Do stay, if you've got time, linger about, chat more fully with question more fully the expert here and other experts that may be in the room. If you don't know anything about or very little about HTC, there's just a little bit of literature over there on the left-hand side, which you're free to take. And this should be, I think, available at the end up at the back. Can we then express our appreciation together for Harry's presentation this evening?
Well, thank you very much for these thanks. I mean, you were, I could tell you were a super audience paying attention. I'd also like just very quickly to thank one or two people. I would like to thank the Highland Theological College for everything they're doing. I sometimes say that as somebody who's occasionally asked to write about the Church of Scotland, and I'm afraid quite often quite critical of the Church of Scotland, I think the Highland Theological College has been an absolutely smashing super development. It is something positive that's happened in the life of the Church, and, you know, long may it continue. I wish you all well. Can I also in particular thank Marina Mackenzie, Hector Morrison, and the librarian I was talking about, Martin, who I have now see. My eyesight is terrible, but I now see him smiling there. We'll have a chat about the Covenanters again. And I'd also like to thank Sandy Hardy, who's my oldest living friend, who's putting me up tonight, and we've just been having a very interesting conversation about this and that. I'd also like to mention just two ladies who are special to me who cannot be here tonight, my wife Julie Davidson and Leslie Duncan. And of course, once again, I want to thank you, because you have been a very attentive and good audience. Thank you.